Chapter 9, History's Most Famous Wedding. Two of John's followers left him and turned to the new teacher. That has been done in all ages. We have liked something new from the time we wanted a new toy, a new playmate, or a new teacher until, in old age, we wanted a new lease of life. As we read with care the manner in which Jesus received these two men, we feel sure he was more perplexed at their leaving John and coming to him than flattered. We probably would have been more flattered than perplexed. After these two men had followed Jesus for a little way without speaking to him, Jesus turned and said to them, "What seek ye?" We see these two men and we hear Jesus speak to them, but our thoughts go back to John the Baptist. We are putting ourselves in John's place and wondering how we should feel at such a desertion of ourselves. John does not show any pique. He does not act as though he felt any. He does not say anything. We look upon him, and it seems as though he was another Moses, willing to be put clear out of sight if only God's will is to be done and the people helped. It is not an easy place to stand where John the Baptist stood. It takes the spirit of a hero. He had recommended Jesus as a teacher, and now his pupils are leaving him to go to the new teacher. He had started a work on which his heart was set, and now another steps in and takes up his work. We can remember just such things that came to pass in our own lives, so we know it was not a real comfortable place where John stood. But a strong character like that which John the Baptist had is not a common character. He began early in life to practice self-denial. It takes a whole season to perfect fall apples. Green apples in June may be perfect green apples, but it takes time to make the perfect fall apple. John was a perfect hero, and he has been an object lesson for boys and girls, for men and women, from that day to this. We can see how cordially he looked toward Jesus as he said, "He must increase then." Without a catch in his voice, he added, "But I must decrease." Not only the two men followed Jesus, but it was not long before three more followed. The names of the two men were Andrew and John. They were fishermen in Galilee, the country where Jesus had lived, and doubtless had known Jesus as a carpenter of Nazareth. They had seen him now and then when all the people came to Jerusalem at the great feasts. They knew him because the mothers were kinswomen or friends. But now he was a rabbi. That was very different from being a carpenter. We are told that the office of rabbi was open to all, as the office of President of the United States is open to all. But to become a rabbi depended wholly upon the person himself. He must begin when he was a lad and study the law and the prophets. So the humblest Jewish boy, if he desired, could become a rabbi, a master of the law. To be a rabbi was a great honor. He was classed with the leaders of old, like Jacob, Moses, or Isaiah. The Jews put all power into the hands of the rabbis. They were not only teachers, but priests, physicians, judges, and magistrates. But they must fill all these offices without compensation. They could take no money for service. As they were usually of the Pharisees, many had ways of evading the law. But it was said, "He who makes gain of the words of the law, his life will be taken from the world." How did they live? They maintained themselves by some trade. The great Rabbi Hillel worked with his hands. One rabbi was a shoemaker, one a needlemaker, one a smith, and another, like St. Paul, who was a rabbi, was a tent cover weaver. While teaching religion, they also taught the people to be industrious. No one today could be treated with more profound respect than were the rabbis in the time of Jesus. Why, to learn a single word from a rabbi was an honor never, never to be forgotten and hard to repay. Among the Jews, the rabbis led the thought of the nation and, almost literally, the muscles of the people. For nearly everything a man, woman, or child wanted to do, the sanction of the rabbi must first be obtained. The house mother could not bake her bread till the rabbi had said she might, just as the men of affairs had to get permission from a rabbi to make a contract, begin a business, or ask the maiden if she would become his betrothed. Yes, the people obeyed, respected, and honored the rabbis, So no wonder that Andrew and John felt a little diffidence in speaking to Jesus and were glad when he turned and asked them, "What seek ye?" They wanted to be courteous, but we can see how their curiosity got the better of their courtesy as they bluntly, though respectfully, asked, "Rabbi, where abidest thou?" He replied, "Come, and ye shall see." We also have curiosity. We should like to know how Jesus was living now that he had become a teacher for his people. We think he took these two men near the Jordan, out among the trees, into something of a ravine by a running brook, for we think he had selected a pleasant and comfortable place for his few days of simple home life. There they stirred the embers and built a fire, just as they would have done if they had gone to their work as fishermen, and it had become 4 o'clock in the afternoon and they were real hungry. After they had eaten with Jesus, had asked many questions, and had talked about many things, they loved him and wanted to be his disciples, wanted to be his pupils, his followers. That evening, when Andrew went back to where his brother Simon was staying, he told all that he and John had been doing, and he said, "I do really believe we have found the Messiah." Simon was just such a man as we all love. If he had a thing to do, he rushed along and did it. If a thought came into his head, he spoke it before he had thought much about it. Then, if he had done wrong or spoken wrong, he was sorry and had to crawfish, just as we do when we are sorry about what we have said or done. As soon as Jesus saw him, he thought what a splendid man he could make. So Jesus told Simon what he thought when he said, "Thou art Simon, the son of John. Thou shalt be called Cephas," which is by interpretation Peter, that is, rock. Jesus saw what Simon could become if he tried, just as God sees what we may become if we try. Simon liked what Jesus said to him, and so he said he would become a disciple. Then Andrew knew about Philip from Bethsaida, the town up at the north of the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus called him to be a follower. Philip knew Nathanael, whose home was in Cana, and he said to Nathanael, "We have seen him of whom Moses and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth. You come with us and be his disciple." Nathanael was a young man with a clean record. He had not a very good opinion of the people who lived in Nazareth, and so he said, "Can any good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said, "You come and see for yourself." Nathanael went with Philip. Jesus met him and won his confidence and love. Some of these men had been much interested in the preaching of John the Baptist and had been baptized of him. They believed all that John had said. He had told them to repent of their sins. They had. He told them not to lie or cheat and to be good to the poor. John did this because he lived in a wilderness. But these men wondered how they could keep on living right when they got among men who were always doing wrong. Could Jesus teach them this? When they were puzzling over these grave questions, someone came and told Jesus that they were invited to a wedding up in Galilee at Cana. He must get there on Wednesday, the day of the week set apart for the marriage. The mother of Jesus was there and quite at home in the house. It is pleasant for us to know that Jesus seemed glad to go to the domestic festivities of a home. He must have had a charm that attracted young folk, or they never would have wanted him at this most important event in all the life. He was happy, and he loved to have others happy. He was glad that his friends wanted him at a wedding. And just think, it was in this social gathering that Jesus took pains to do good and to help others to believe on him. We are glad that Jesus left his work and went to a wedding. He knew that the home that made him a guest at the very first would be a home that would be a bit of the real paradise before the fall. So off they started for a 2 or 3 days' walk from the Jordan through a beautiful country where the early spring flowers were in bloom and the grass was springing up green beneath their feet. And there were with Jesus, Andrew, Peter, John, probably James, Philip, and Nathanael. Betrothal and marriage were affairs of great ceremony with the Jews. The betrothal was celebrated with a feast, and the bridegroom placed a ring on the bride's finger, a token of fidelity and of adoption into the family. She was now really regarded as the wife of her future husband, and faithlessness on her part was punishable with death. The husband, however, having the choice of death or simply putting her away. The marriage was a formal ratification of the espousal oath. The bridegroom was in festive attire with frankincense and all the powders of the merchant. The bride had her festive robes, the chief of which was her veil, not worn hanging down her back, but was of thin material and contained yards and yards, so that it not only covered her face, but her whole person. She also wore a peculiar girdle, and perhaps a garland of flowers on her head. Her robes were white, and if she were of a wealthy family, they were embroidered with gold threads, and she was covered with costly perfumes and decked with jewels. When the fixed hour arrived, the bridegroom set forth from his house, late in the evening attended by the groomsmen, children of the bride chamber. Musicians and singers and torchbearers preceded them. When this procession reached the home of the bride, they escorted her and her maidens, with great rejoicings, back to the home of the bridegroom. On the way back, other maidens who had waited for the procession joined it. At this house a feast was prepared, to which crowds of friends were invited. It was the great social event of the town and vicinity. For 7 and even 14 days, the joyous ceremonies were held. The host, if able, prepared wedding garments for the guests and furnished the feast, music, riddles, and other amusements. At this wedding to which Jesus and his disciples had come, the mother of Jesus had some care and responsibility. We read that toward the close of the week she went to Jesus and told him of the great danger of the host coming short of supplies. It would be a disgrace to him if this should happen. All his lifetime she had known of the unselfish life of Jesus and his rare good judgment. She had learned to lean on him, her son. She knew he would know what to do, so she came to him. Perhaps his mother suggested that 5 unexpected guests had partially caused this disaster. Perhaps Jesus felt the responsibility she had laid upon him. Perhaps it was only because he wanted to make his host and the bride feel comfortable. Perhaps it was because his mother had faith that he could and would help her. Anyway, he saw the great water jars, 6 of them. They were of stone and held 3 firkins each. He told the servants to fill them all with fresh water. They filled them to the brim. The songs and music, gossip and laughter were all around him. The air was full of the odors of the fruits, the flowers, the feast. It took a whole long season for the vine to grow, to blossom, to bear grapes, and have the juice pressed from them. But for the sake of the comfort of others, he told the servants to draw from the water pots and carry to the guests to drink. The servants knew it was water. The guests said, "It is wine. It is delicious wine. It is the best we have had, and there is abundance of it for all." When the ceremonies were all over, Jesus and his followers and other guests walked from Cana to Capernaum. But the guests at the wedding, the people in the city, and soon the people all over the country, and later all over the world, never ceased talking about this wedding at Cana of Galilee, where Jesus performed his first miracle and turned water into wine.